This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Militant Islamic fundamentalists are challenging governments across the Arab world. Arab governments are cracking down against the militants. In Tunis, the interior ministers of Egypt, Algeria, and Tunisia just met to widen cooperation and exchange intelligence on the activities of Muslim fundamentalists. Last month, Israel deported over 400 Palestinians accused of being militant Muslim fundamentalists who threaten Israel's security. My guest Chris Hedges is Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. He's based in Cairo. We called him earlier today at his parents' home in Syracuse, New York, where he's been visiting for the holidays. He told me you can see signs of the growing fundamentalist movement in the streets of Cairo, where more women are wearing the veil. I asked him if he thinks women are wearing it voluntarily or because they're afraid of being harassed if they don't.
I think it's both. I mean, I think in poor neighborhoods, it's clearly a fear of reprisals where the fundamentalists control your alley or your street. There's going to be a certain harassment if you don't wear the veil. But I think that I wouldn't say that it's exclusively so. Women, for instance, poor women find that this is a respectable way to dress without having to spend a lot of money on clothes. It means that when they walk through the streets of Cairo, they're not going to get hassled by guys. It's a statement of their own personal morality, and also it's a sign of protest. Those of us in the West may look at this and see it as antiquated, but for an Arab, this is a way of sort of tweaking your nose at the powers that be because the powers that be don't like it. And I think that's an important element of the whole Islamic movement, especially among the young. And it's why it's really taken root in universities throughout the Middle East.
King Hussein of Jordan has said that he thinks secular governments are over in the Arab world, and he sees Islamic democracy as the future, that the future lies in modernizing Islam. Is he alone in seeing it that way? Are there other leaders of the Arab world who feel the same way?
Well, he's certainly alone when compared to his neighbors in Syria or Iraq. They have no desire to modernize Islam, and both Hafez al-Assad and Saddam Hussein, along with others like Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, have been very, very rough, brutal with their fundamentalist movement. So there's been no attempt by many of these governments to build a coalition. And in Algeria, of course, under this military junta, they've really moved to wipe out any trace of Islam, not only within the government, of course, but within the street. I mean, people with beards and skull caps are picked up and questioned and given a much rougher treatment just because of their physical appearance. So I would say, number one, he's in a minority. Number two, I'm not quite sure what he means. Islam has always played an important part in the Arab world and has always been a force that has had to be reckoned with. What is modern Islam and what is, I mean, this, these are theological sort of interpretations. I'm not quite clear what he's driving at, other than I know that the king is no friend of the fundamentalists.
If Islamic militants took over Arab governments, if they succeeded in taking over the governments, how do you think the governments would be changed? What do you think life would be like under Islamic fundamentalist governments?
Well, you'd have a lot of unemployed belly dancers in Cairo, just to start. There'd be a certain... These guys place a great emphasis on personal piety, at least the public face of it. You'd have the nightclubs and stuff closed down. A city like Cairo would be changed dramatically, as was Tehran, which was a big sort of den of iniquity or whatever, at least in the Arab world, with strips and stuff like this. There's a certain strain of intolerance in this movement towards any group or organization or viewpoint that is not seen as Islamic. Well, they can, as in Iran, tolerate divisions and disputes within their own circle. They are completely intolerant of people, of especially secularists. Well, anybody outside of this Islamic movement. So I think we'd see that. I think the secular press would get wiped out. Uh, I worry that there would be a certain amount of bloodletting. There'd be a lot of revenge, which we saw in Iran after the revolution. I think we'd probably also see a fair exodus, which we also saw in Iran. And this worries the Europeans, and especially the French, of people who just, feel they have nothing left to lose by packing up and leaving the country.
In December, Israel expelled 400 people who were accused of being Islamic fundamentalists who threatened Israel's security. I wonder if you think, that although Arab countries have condemned Israel for expelling these Islamic fundamentalists, you could say that a lot of the Arab governments have done far worse in their fight against Islamic fundamentalists. Algeria moved 9,000 suspected Islamic militants to remote camps in the Sahara. Egypt jailed about 1,000 suspects in the last 6 months, and in July issued a death penalty for members of organizations deemed terrorist.
Yeah, I think that's true. Which is probably why they're not burning the midnight oil in Cairo or anywhere else to sort of get these guys out of the fix they're in. I think that it may not be stated, but there's a certain sympathy for the Israelis in this particular instance.
Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said, just as the state of Israel was the first to recognize the Iraqi nuclear danger, thus we stand first today in the line of fire against the danger of extremist Islam. Do you think that there's any chance of Israel uniting with Arab leaders around the issue of Islamic militants?
I doubt it. I'm not sure that, for instance, the Egyptians view their problem with Islamic fundamentalists as of the same fabric. It's part of the same fabric as the Israeli problem with Islamic fundamentalists. I think there are certain parallels, but I don't know that Arab leaders would. I think they'd be very reluctant to ever admit it. And let me just add there that this has become the new Israeli line. Before the collapse of the Soviet Union, they were the bulwark of democracy and U.S. security, etc. In the Middle East, now they're at the forefront of fighting Islamic fundamentalism. And I go to Gaza, and I go to Algiers, and I find a certain similarity. And the similarity is that the governing power in Algiers or in Gaza is discredited and unwanted. And that's the similarity. But the notion that somehow this is some kind of viral infection that they're going to help stomp out misses the whole point of why this movement exists and why it's growing.
You were just in Israel before coming to the States for the holidays. What is the debate in Israel like about the expulsion of the Islamic militants?
There isn't a lot of debate. The opinion poll, I think it was Audits, or one of the major papers ran, I think it was the day or day after of the expulsion, was 91% of Israelis backed it. I did find, interestingly, that this was incredibly unsettling to the Israeli Arabs, the 760,000 Arabs who carry Israeli passports and live inside the Green Line, members of the State of Israel. Not full members, of course, but members of the State of Israel. And this sort of realized their worst fears, this deportation. And you've had a lot of activity by Israeli Arabs in response to the deportation, increased sort of protests in front of the prime minister's office. They tried to drive to the security zone with food. So I found that this was, while Israelis didn't seem to be particularly torn over whether or not they should have done this, it did seem to drive a further, if you can go any further, a wedge, certainly with the Arabs in the territories because you had increased violence, but also with the Arabs inside Israel. And that's something that the Israelis have always been very worried about, because this is an indigenous Arab population that even if they work something out with the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, they're always going to have this group within their own society.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Chris Hedges, Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Chris Hedges is my guest, Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. How close do you get to talking to leaders of the Islamic groups, the Islamic militant groups?
Well, we talk to them all the time.
How do you arrange the meetings? Are they open to talking with you?
Well, you know, I come, you know, I'm a representative of the great Satan. That's always sort of an element in any conversation. But, you know, many of these people have become much more sophisticated and recognize the importance of talking to the press. So in Cairo, they'll contact us, the major news agencies. We'll meet them at a prearranged location, usually at night. They will take us in what they consider a safe taxi, i.e. a taxi driver who is a member of their group, often on a circuitous route, to meet the leaders who will speak to us. And this is fairly common. In Algeria, things are much tighter, but I was able to meet a leader of the FIS, I have no idea of what rank, on a back street, but in an idling car. I mean, the situation there now is so dangerous. So yes, we do have contact with them, but at the same time, there is a strong degree of distrust.
Do you tape conversations?
I don't usually tape conversations, and sometimes I don't even use a notebook. It depends how sensitive it is. For instance, in the meeting with the FIS leader, I just felt that he'd be too spooked if I started pulling out a notebook, and I didn't.
Does anybody ever try to get information from you on the whereabouts of the militant groups?
No, although in Egypt, of course, I mean, we're fairly certain that they monitor us pretty closely. And, you know, I had my news assistant one night. He came out of my apartment. He had just been meeting with them in the afternoon, and he got into a cab, and it turns out that it was security. And they sort of grilled him and spooked him a bit. And so they monitor us, but I've never been called in and asked to, you know, turn over my date book or tell them, you know, who I met with and where, etc.
My guest is Chris Hedges, Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. Chris, at the close of the Gulf War, you were held hostage by Iraqis. And,
wasn't held hostage.
You were captured.
Yeah.
Yeah. Captured by Iraqis. Okay. I was kind of surprised that you went back there after you were released. So you went back to the Middle East. I think a lot of people would have preferred just a safer position closer to home after an ordeal like that.
Well, first of all, I never found the Gulf War to approach, in terms of my own feelings of sort of insecurity, anything that I went through in El Salvador. I mean, there were moments in El Salvador in this guerrilla warfare in the early 80s when I sort of thought I wasn't going to come out of it, a particular situation.
Because of crossfire or being captured? Or
no, well, everything. I mean, we were, of course, held at gunpoint by the Contras. I and Tom Jelden from NPR held in a cornfield, and I think they were really sort of figuring on the radio whether they were just going to off us or let us go. So I didn't. I found the Gulf War, there were moments, of course, that were frightening, but I didn't find it on the sort of sustained daily level of the same intensity as the war in El Salvador now 10 years ago. Why do I go back? I mean, I do this for a living. I've done it for a long time. So, I mean, it's what I know how to do. It's not what I'm going to do forever. I don't think anyone should. But it's, you know, I look at it as my profession. I mean, I see it as something that I do professionally, and I try and do it professionally. It's not, it's not a wild joyride into combat.
I guess part of what you've learned as a war correspondent is how to behave if you're captured, because you've been captured in Iraq and in Central America. Are there things you learned the hard way by doing it wrong?
If I did it that wrong, I wouldn't be here.
I guess so.
Yeah, you do learn a lot. And, you know, in Central America, for instance, finally, I just, you know, there was a Salvadoran journalist who I worked with, and he was the only person I'd go out with. Because in a very tense situation, you do have to keep your equilibrium. And, I mean, they're all sort of little techniques, you know, never raising your voice, and never sort of being nervous, and never being spooked, always speaking the language. For instance, doesn't speak Arabic. And I said, well, you know, for the next 45 minutes, it's going to be no English, because always the first encounter when we were pulled out of the seats at the AK-47s pointed at us and shoved in the back, etc., raced across the desert are the most tense. I'm not sure they always know what they're going to do. You know, you certainly don't know what they're going to do, and you don't want to start turning to your colleague and speaking in a language they don't know. So, I mean, there are little sort of things you learn over the years that I think help you. Again, you know, it's a bit of a wild card. One can never predict how a lot of times these people are going to react, and even if you do everything right, it doesn't mean you're going to come out of it.
Now, I know you told Neil that he shouldn't look at pictures of his family while he was being held.
Right.
How did you figure out that's something that would weaken your resolve?
Well, it's not just pictures of the family. You know, you really want to concentrate on the present. You can't help but sort of anticipate or worry about what's going to happen to you, but you want to keep that to a minimum. I think it's just you don't want to make yourself any more vulnerable than you already are. And by pulling out and looking at pictures of your family, it's certainly the worst part of it. I don't know that I went through a particular experience where I learned that. I just learned after a while that there are certain segments of your emotional life that in a situation like that you really want to block out and just try and think as analytically and as coldly as possible.
Did you have an infant when you were being held captive?
8 months, it was.
That must have made it particularly hard.
It was very hard, but, you know, to be honest, I tried not to think about him too much. I mean, it's pretty deadly if you start to dwell on stuff like that.
No, in a situation where you're being held captive, do you try desperately to communicate to your guards that you're human and that you're important? For instance, I'm a New York Times correspondent. There's going to be a lot of angry people in America if you hurt me.
Whether you want to communicate whether you're important or not, it depends on the personality of the guard, because that could backfire. I mean, you could very much come off as sort of a swaggering, arrogant American. I'm more interested in communicating with them as a level, you know, on the same level. And, you know, I always ask them about their kids, they had a family, how long. And most of these guys had fought in the war with Iran. They were sick of the army. And, you know, a lot of them had lost brothers. You know, I mean, it's that kind of opening that kind of channel, you know, from one human being to another that I think is the most important. I think it really depends on who's holding you as to whether or not you want to start getting into how important you are, because that very much could just sort of make them flick the safety off their rifle if you're too obnoxious about it.
Right after you were released, you wrote a really eloquent article about being held captive. It was an article that was in the New York Times, a front-page story. I was wondering if you started writing that article in your head while you were still being held captive.
Well, that's an interesting story. I didn't want to write that article. And I think in retrospect, I was wrong. But I very much, and this is part of the whole sort of notion of being a professional, at least trying to be a professional. You know, I had a lot of people that I worked with in Central America were killed covering the war. And a lot of us, you know, on a daily basis, many of my colleagues, you know, hold up with great respect, went through a lot. And they got out of it and they wrote the story. And they really didn't dwell on what they went through. So, you know, after 5 years of covering the civil wars in Central America, I had really just as a certain amount of professional pride, didn't want to bring up my own sort of personal experiences. And it was Johnny Apple, who was on vacation in Italy at the time, who called me and sort of, you know, made me do it. And his argument was, you know, we've just fought this war with Iraq. These guys have essentially been two-dimensional figures. This type of an article will help people realize that what we're talking about is human beings. We're talking about broken lives. It will give another sort of human dimension to the whole situation, and I think he was correct. article at all.
But now you're glad you did?
Yeah.
Why?
I think he was right. Because I think it did do that. I think it, these were the, Neil and I were held by the Republican Guard. And this was sort of, you know, this is Saddam's unit. And these were, you know, certainly they took care of us for the week. There was a certain rapport that was built between us. These people had suffered a lot. I think a lot of them were not particularly thrilled to be driving into Kuwait. And I think if it worked, I think it certainly made the drive, the goal of the article was to make people to stop and think. And you know, when I came back to the States after the war and saw this kind of flag waving and the kind of euphoria within the States, I was just disgusted because while I felt that the Gulf War was probably necessary, war is never something to exult in, or, I mean, it's not like winning the Super Bowl. We're talking about immense amounts of suffering, not only in Iraq, but to the families of the soldiers who died in the Gulf. And in that sense, it was my own small contribution to making, hopefully, people stop and realize that this isn't a game, that this is human life, that this is tragic.
Well, Chris Hedges, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all.
Chris Hedges is Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with us from his parents' home in Syracuse, New York, where he's been visiting for the holidays. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.